Welcome to the Beekeeper's Corner podcast. Today is August 9th, 2011, and this is episode 19, Hooked on a Feeling. Welcome one and all to the Beekeeper's Corner podcast. My name is Kevin England. The theme of this episode is Hooked on a Feeling. Ooga chaka, ooga, ooga, ooga chaka, ooga, ooga. Our feature segment this episode centers upon a new study and whether we need to rethink our notions about insects having feelings. In this episode, we'll also bring you a one-on-one with the American Beekeeping Federation Honey Queen, Teresa Bryson. I found a follow-up to our last episode's segment on bee sting mortality statistics. This time, they're from south of the border in Mexico. I've got a master beekeeper's rundown of stinging insects and their attributes, and we'll spend the time musing about the local county fair. We'll also throw in a term for this episode, bee lining, and a talk about the technique. That's a full plate of victuals, so let's get our bibs on and dive right in. As always, we'll get things kicked off with our local hive report. Three hives out in the yard, three hives going strong. Everything looks good doing those mite counts here in July and August. If you haven't done yours, please, 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 now is the time. You want to make sure you do those mite counts so that you can ensure at least two good runs of bees to the first frost and that you can get over winter. Do your mite counts, whether you're doing sugar roll, whether you're doing powdered sugar, and checking them through the screen bottom board on the covers, whatever method you use, now is the time. We're talking about Varroa mites in the hives. Hive number one on ours, we did a couple powdered sugar treatments. We saw some rays in the mites there towards the end of spring. And actually, as we did our last mite counts, we're down and we do not need to treat that one. Hive two and three are a little bit different. Didn't do mite counts on them until recently. And turns out we're loaded with mites on both of those. So gonna take out the Apigard this time around, getting ready tomorrow to put the treatment on hives two and three. Right now, had to work last weekend to get the configuration set for mite treatments. Had the Honey Super still on the boxes. Took all of the excess Honey Supers off, left them all with one. So we're running a two hive deep configuration with a one medium on top. One medium on all the hives has honey inside. For the two hives that we're going to treat, we're going to take off those two honey supers. You don't want them on board when you put the Apigard in. Spent a little time today reviewing the instructions on how to treat with Apigard. And ready to do that, going to place our emery shims into service so that we have a little space for the tin of Apigard to go on there. For the most part, the bees look good. It's been relatively warm here for the summertime in New Jersey. The bees were bearding out of hive two and three recently. Hive number one, just kind of docile right now. The hive one, if you remember, is carniolian queens, and there's not a lot out there for them nectar wise. They are out pulling a little bit of pollen, but the bees seem to have taken a little bit of a respite. The two Italian hives, two and three, are rocking. They continue to just go out and forage every day and are hammering. Not sure what they're after, but they are out doing something. The corn next door to our field, to where we have our hives placed, that field, the corn's got to be 5 foot high. It's in tassel right now. That is the corn that I mentioned has neonicotinoids in it, as we got the tag from the farmer as to what corn they planted. So far, haven't seen any adverse reactions. Not even sure if the bees are up on the corn. We see them flying up and around or over the cornfield, but it is what it is, and there's not much you're going to do about it. Local hive report, hive 1, 2, and 3, doing pretty well. Queen right, and we're going to do some hive treatments for two and three to get rid of, knock down that mite load. Get a place set on and gonna pull those honey supers off and check out the hives and see how they respond to this Apigard. We'll do our mite treatments and continue to keep our bees good and going here into the fall honey flow. That's it for the local hive report. Time to get to segment number one. And for that, we've had the pleasure recently of hosting the American Beekeeping Federation Honey Queen, Teresa Bryson from Chambersburg, Pennsylvania, which isn't too far from here in New Jersey. But Teresa came by way of Washington State, as you'll hear in the interview. Did a great job for us at the Warren County Fair and really enjoyed having a chance to talk to her. Knowledgeable about beekeeping and very passionate about what she does, and a fortunate young woman who is confident and gets a chance of a lifetime this summer to roll in that position. And we're going to let you listen to an interview with her right now. Teresa Bryson was selected as the American Honey Queen this past January during the North American Beekeeping Conference and Trade Show in Galveston, Texas. As the American Honey Queen, Teresa has been traveling all through the United States promoting beekeeping and the honey industries through visits to schools, fairs, festivals, and participating in media interviews such as this one. Teresa, welcome to the Beekeeper's Corner podcast. It's such a pleasure to get the opportunity to speak with you.
Thank you for having me. It's an honor to have the opportunity to speak to you about what I do as the American Honey Queen.
You're here visiting New Jersey on behalf of the Northwest New Jersey Beekeepers Association, of which I'm an officer of. We asked you to work with us for our participation in the Warren County Farmers Fair, and we'll talk about that in a moment. But first, I wanted to chat with you about what it means to be the Honey Queen for the American Beekeepers Federation and about how your year has gone so far. You came to us this week from an event in Minnesota. Tell us a little bit about that.
I was in Minnesota for a pollinator party, which was an event in a park outside of Minneapolis, and it was to educate the public about honeybees and native pollinators and their importance.
So from Minnesota to New Jersey, that's quite a change in landscape. You know, I know, too, that you were with us for a number of days this week, and then you're off to Liberty Airport for a flight to Washington State. It must be pretty exciting to get to spend your summer representing the ABF in so many locations. Can you give us an idea of the forward-looking schedule that you have coming up?
Oh, from Washington State, I go to the Kentucky State Fair, then the Oregon State Fair, and then I'm back to Washington for two more states' fairs. I'll be at a fair in California, Topsfield Fair in Boston, and then beekeeping conferences in the fall.
Wow, that's an incredible, ambitious schedule, and you get to go all over the place. Do you get to check in at home at all during that?
I do get to check in at home just a little bit. I will be home for a few days in August, then gone till October.
Wow, you're young. That's great, and I'm sure you're going to enjoy that summer. The American Honey Queen and Princess program goes back a long way, if I have my notes right, 1959. There must really be a great sense of pride in being able to wear the crown.
Yes, there is. I became interested in the American Honey Queen program when I was the Pennsylvania Honey Queen last year. And to compete for the national title, I had to write an essay and give many presentations at the American Beekeeping Federation's convention.
So I believe it would be easy to say that you're pretty good at public speaking. As you get to sit here and rattle off this interview, there's a lot of times when you have to do some FaceTime. Ever get a little bit nervous about that, standing in front of people and talking?
I do. The thing that gets me the most nervous is TV interviews, because they're live.
Yeah, and certainly you want to make sure that you don't come across looking goofy as a teenager, I'm sure. But that's why I do podcasts. No video involved. People don't get to see. I have a face for radio, if you might say. So tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I am a beekeeper. I have been a beekeeper for 4 years, and I have 5 beehives. I am also a senior in college, and I'm double majoring in forensic science and English. I am a 10-year 4-H member, and I am now a leader in 2 clubs, and I live on a small farm with my parents, 2 brothers, and a sister.
Well, so you have bees and you have a farm. I'm assuming you have some other animals that you take care of. Does the morning start early for you?
It did start very early when I was little, not so much now. On my farm, we have sheep and a goat and a large garden, so we don't have to get up quite as early as dairy farmers do.
Wow, it sounds interesting, and I'm sure all your siblings love it while you're traipsing away and they have to take care of all the critters. You must meet a lot of interesting people while representing the Honey Queen role. If you will, tell us what some of the activities you perform in your travel. What's a typical day in the life for you as the Honey Queen?
Well, what I do varies each day, but when I'm at a fair, I usually do cooking demonstrations, media interviews, I answer any questions the public has about honeybees, I give hive demonstrations, and during the school year, I also give school presentations.
Yeah, and this past week in our fair, you made a tropical drink which had honey in it, obviously, and it was really good. A big hit for the fair. It looks like that's something that you get to do. How about cooking demonstrations? That must be pretty challenging. You got to find a kitchen and then stand up there in front and cook all these people. Any aspirations for TV Food Network or something like that?
Not as of now, but anything is possible. I do enjoy cooking, so you never know. Might see me on Food Network in the future.
Very cool. So, you know, you get to do this public speaking, but I'd imagine that it's an interesting dynamic to manage a diverse set of people you get to speak with. In your line of travels here, you get to talk to the general public who have one set of conception, and you probably get to talk to educated beekeepers or people that are enthusiastic from the hobby side.
Yes, when I speak to the public, the most important message that I speak about is how important honeybees are for pollination. Most people do not realize that they pollinate almost one-third of all of our food. And when I speak to beekeepers, I encourage them to invite the honey queen or princess to their state to help them promote our great industry.
Yeah, you and I had a conversation on a range of topics this week, CCD, feral bees. It seems that you have a lot of exposure to the ins and outs of beekeeping.
Yes, this year I have had the opportunity to attend many beekeeping conferences, and I've also met many of the researchers that are trying to discover what is causing the decline in honeybees.
Well, so I'm going to take you off topic for a second. We had a conversation about the universal topic, which is music, and I'm still dismayed to learn that you don't know who Huey Lewis and the News is, my favorite band. So, you know, we have a little work to do here. What's going on, Teresa? We need to make your box a little bit bigger here. I'm going to send you home with some Huey Lewis, some Hall & Oates, some old school 70s and 80s stuff. What are you going to send me home with?
Well, I can send you home with some Katy Perry and maybe some Avril Lavigne.
Yeah, okay. I have diverse tastes, so I can handle that Katy Perry thing. I know a couple of her songs. Huey Lewis, though. Come on, Huey Lewis. All right, so what's in store for you for the rest of the year?
Well, after I finish going to all the state fairs and beekeeping conferences, the last thing that I will do is go to the American Beekeeping Federation's convention in January. It's a week-long convention, and this January it will be in Las Vegas. So everyone should come. It will be a great convention. Lots of speakers from all over the country will be there.
So inquiring minds want to know, something interesting must have happened in your time working in a fair. Something embarrassing, something you forgot, some flub, something. I just have to ask this question. Tell me, what do you think stands out in your mind in that type of, you get what I'm after. What happened, Teresa? Tell us the story.
At one fair that I was at, I was doing cooking demonstration, and the recipe I was making I'd never made before. So I learned how to make it right along with everyone in the audience.
Well, no pressure there at all. Well, and the other thing is that you guys offer cooking recipes. You have a brochure that we've been handing out this week, and demonstrating the punch that you made is in there. There's other information about your program, and it's available on the web. Why don't you give us a little plug for ABF?
Well, the ABF website is abfnet.org, and it has all the information on the American Honey Queen program. The American Honey Queen program also has a blog. It's buzzingacrossamerica.com, and you can also find us on Facebook.
And I understand you have a conference coming up, a pretty big conference that you'll be. Is that the end of your honeybee reign, or how do you turn it over?
That will be the end. At the ABF convention in January, I will be crowning the 2012 American Honey Queen.
And if somebody's interested in holding the crown next year, how do they go about that?
Well, to compete for the American title, you have to have been a state queen. So any state queen that has been a state queen for more than 6 months and is in as the 2011 state queen can run for the national title as long as she is between 18 and 24.
And we should not be remiss in reminding the fact that you're the queen, but there is a princess out there also.
There is a princess. This year, the princess is from Texas, and she has been traveling all over the country, just like I have, and she was at a beekeeping conference last week in Rhode Island.
Wow, that's interesting. So our time has come to an end, but I want to take a moment and thank you for stopping by and for all that you do for the ABF and for beekeeping. And it's really been a pleasure to talk to you, and we hope we get to chat with you or your future successors down the road. Come and join us again. Thank you for coming to New Jersey and all that you do for beekeeping.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here in New Jersey.
A recent article from the Scientific American Journal explored the topic of insect feelings. Long thought to be void of nerve systems that are needed to demonstrate feelings, bees are often the subject of debate when considering their behavior to their surroundings. Anecdotally, beekeepers will invariably express that bees do have a temperament, and that on off occasions they demonstrate behaviors that, when described, do resemble human emotion, anger, stress, relaxed, anxious, to name a few. In the article, it indicates that humans have, quote, 100,000 bee brains worth of neurons in our heads, end quote. So how does one examine the feelings of a bee? In this case, they used a set of controlled activities to subject bees to preordained scenarios that measured their response. Through monitored behavior and tests in change of systematic neurotransmitters. In the experiment, they educated the bees and measured their response to two formulations of a food product. For the one, they had a component of sucrose, which was desirable to the bees, and for the second one, it was paired with quinine, a natural bitter-tasting anti-inflammatory that is derived from the bark of a South American family of trees. In order to gauge feelings, they first did the test with all the bees and measured their response to the two control products. Then they took half the bees and shook them in a machine designed to vigorously mix chemicals. If you've seen this machine, and there is a video, I'll provide you a link, it really shakes them. In the first round of the experiment, the trained bees, when exposed to the first time to the two different mixtures, gave the mixtures the benefit of the doubt and tried to see if it was palatable. In other words, they tried it, which is an important concept. Upon exposing the shaken bees, they determined that they were less interested in trying the product, even if it might mean a pleasurable experience. The metaphor presented in this article is that they went from a glass half full presentation to a glass half empty after being shaken. After being shaken, they were just aggravated and wanted nothing to do with it, even if it could mean pleasure. In addition to the physical tests of whether the bees attempted to feed, they also measured the transmitters that are associated with bee learning and found that these neurotransmitters were all reduced by procedure. Measured the electrical activity, not so interested it showed up in the neurotransmitters also. The article concludes that the aforementioned behavioral and neurochemical tests revealed an unexpected dimension of bee cognition. If you pause for a moment to ponder that age-old question about smushing an ant on the sidewalk, this presents an interesting dynamic about how we perceive the insects in our environment. The article cited is available on our show notes, along with a link to the original study. The original study is entitled Agitated Honeybees Exhibit Pessimistic Cognitive Biases and could be found in the journal Current Biology, Volume 21, Issue 12, from June 21st, 2011. We've also provided a web source link to the study on our show notes. On that link is a video, as I said before, that explains the experiment and is well worth the preview. Before we close out this topic, time for a Kevin moment. Take this discussion and apply it to the practice of beekeeping after taking honey off the hive. I've read, and it has been suggested on the web, that it demoralizes the bees when we take all their stores. Now, I don't want to anamorphize the bees, but I can't help shake that sense that they do seem a bit more dejected in that period after the harvest. What do you think? Do you see all that? I'd be interested in hearing if you feel that to be true. Drop me off a note at kevin@bkcorner.com if you have any thoughts on that idea. Last episode, I brought you stats about how to talk to people concerning the number of deaths from stinging insects. There were some facts and figures in there about how many people die from insects and how many insects it takes to kill someone. If you remember, the answer is just one if you're allergic, but other than that, it's 10 stings per pound on average based on who you are. There was an article I found in the Journal of Allergy and Clinical Immunology. Yes, I found it through beekeeping, not that I go read all these journals. It was termed Accidents and Mortalities from Honeybee Stings in Mexico. So they studied bee stings nationwide from 1988 to 2009, and I thought this was an interesting follow-up to what we had. So gathered from the offices of the Program for Control of Africanized Honeybees throughout the country, they were used to show the number of accidents, people involved in deaths related to honeybee stings, which occurred in Mexico in 1988 and 2009. Now, mind you, they have Africanized bees. We don't, unless you live in a region in the U.S. where they have come across the border. So these are the results. People suffering from multiple or massive honeybee stings were reported in all states of the country in Mexico. Between 1988 and 1998, there were 360 honeybee-related accidents involving more than 500 people. Colonies and swarms were responsible for the majority of deaths in some years. Careless behavior about honeybee swarms, hives, and colonies were the cause most related to deaths. From 1988 to 2009, there were 480 demised persons with an annual average of 21.8. If memory serves me right, the U.S. was somewhere around 50, so they have half or a little less than half than what we do for all of Mexico. Regarding age, people over 50 years were the most affected ones. Mostly dead cases, 340 were reported from 1990 to 1999 with an annual average of 34, and between 2000 and 2009, 118 mortal cases. Conclusions: there were an average of 21 annual death cases related to honeybee stings from 1988 to 2009. Toxic reactions caused by multiple stings are mostly the probable death cause in many cases. There were a decrease in the mortality rate associated to honeybee stings in the last decade. I guess, as I said, I don't get my jollies over this thing, but I thought it was pretty interesting to find something in Mexico, and it has more current information right up to 2009, and it just goes to show that, you know, as bad as honeybees are, and Africanized honeybees certainly are more of a problem than what we have here, it appears that the danger from honeybees is not as bad as people make them out. It's time for this episode's term of the day, or better said, term of the episode, since we don't do this every day. Today's term is beeline. I have an interest in feral colonies. I read a statement on a webpage that said there is a 90% reduction of feral bees in just the past 20 years. I'm fascinated if this can be true and would love to know what the real story is on that. This goes back to that undertone about releasing swarms from our managed hives. Is it a viable way to reproduce bees in nature? Why don't beekeepers have an interest in that? In doing some first blush research on that topic, I thought about the premise about how does one find a feral beehive? I came across a website at www.savethehives.com. This website is home to the Feral Bee Project. This project is to help locate, map, and save feral bees. It's an interesting endeavor in its own right, and one that I'm going to have to spend some more time reviewing. But the fact of the matter is, I did find one half to the answer of the questions that I want. How does one find a feral hive? The site has a tutorial on bee lining, an ancient technique using observation and math to come up with a trajectory for finding feral stock. In short, bee lining has its origins when this was a legitimate employed activity. Beekeepers or people in search of honey would use this technique to locate hives for domestication or honey stores. The procedure is pretty simple, really. You find bees out foraging and collect a representative sample. You move away from the original location to a predetermined distance and release some of the collected bees and determine what direction they're going after they depart. Now, mind you, you'll want to feed them nectar or honey so when they head off to the hive, they have a full stomach and they actually head off to the hive and don't give you a false reading. After getting some bearings from what we'll call release site A, go back to your original starting spot. Now go in the opposite direction from release site A, the same predetermined distance to what we'll call release site B. From there, again, you want to make sure you have the bees fed, you'll release some more and watch the angle they go to return back to the hive. Now what you have basically is from point A to point B, you have a line, and you have the angles from point A to the hive and point B to the hive that create a triangle, and you can triangulate where the bees came from. When you have your bearings, you can actually measure the distance between A and B and take an angulation and figure out where exactly it is using a theory. Yes, there's math involved, but it's not that complex. So this is complex to describe, simple to see by the illustration provided on the website link that I'll provide. You can go to our site, bkcorner.org, and look at the show notes, or go to savethehives.com and look at the article on beelining. For a more detailed explanation, you can also check out a resource at beehunting.com, beehunting. There you can see examples of the bee boxes used to collect feral bees on the plants, and a tutorial even on how to use GPS technology to plot the bees in Google Maps and other places. So as noted, of course, we'll have links in the show notes on our website, bkcorner.org. Those websites, savethehives.com, beehunting.com. That's our term of the day, beeline, and I've always heard that, but never understood what it is. Now we're a little bit wiser. July and August is a typical fair season for many beekeeper clubs, and this is no exception for us. As you've heard in the interview with the Honey Queen, we just recently completed the Warren County Fair in Warren County, New Jersey, and we're soon to have the Hunterdon County Fair, which is in our local hometown here in Ringgoes, New Jersey. The fair was an interesting aspect. I went on a Saturday morning and spent the majority of the day there. We had a bee cage, and the funny story is that we forgot to bring a smoker, so I had to go in there hot. Thankfully, I had a full gear, and I did go in there with full suit on, but you know, the bees were pretty good. The people were totally fascinated. As I walked around the fair and looked at different things, nothing draws the people in like a hive of bees sitting in a bee cage. And having the conversation with them, a lot of people routinely ask, is the problem with the bees still going on? It serves to remind me that CCD was a big splash. A lot of people knew about it. The media did make quite an impact upon people, but then there's no coverage. And while there's still a lot of research and questions and concerns about the bee population, the public is not generally aware of it. That's one observation from the day of talking to people. You see the different types of people, and I just talked about bee sting mortality. Some people will walk to the far side of the aisle and not even come up to the cage, even though all the bees are in. It fascinates me that you couldn't even convince them to come on over and have a conversation. They will walk on by, and if you make eye contact, they will beat feed. So others will stand there incessantly and talk to you about bees. They are so fascinated. I am sure and positive and 100% clear that some of the people I talk to will by next year be beekeepers because they were that fascinated in it. But in general, the common question is how many bees were in the hive. In our situation, we had combined Cornelian queens and Italian queens, or Italian bees, I should say, sorry, together to try and build a hive. It was something that we did, and it did not work as an experiment. So the whole time I was standing in the box, there was a great war going on, and the Italian bees won and stung most of the Cornelians, which were laying as corpses and twitching at my feet all the way through. So many people asking why the dead bees were there. So much so that we had to go get some more Italians. So make a note. Not that you should ever try this, but the experiment had gone poorly. Do not combine different races of bees together in a box. And typically what happens, maybe in haste for the fair, you would try and acclimate the bees, but here it did not work. Overall, enjoyed the experience. Got to meet the honey queens from New Jersey. And again, we had the honey queen in from the American Beekeepers Federation. She was very nice, and they did a great job promoting the booth and going out, handing out balloons to the kids, and just generally keeping a great atmosphere about it. If you're interested, I would suggest that you do seek some counsel if you're having a fair to get a honey princess, a honey queen in there. They really do a great job at promoting and drawing people in. From a monetary standpoint, it's a good thing for our club, as we do sell honey there. And a lot of people were asking the questions about the different types. We had clover honey and we had wildflower honey. A lot of interest in using honey as a pollen source or for preventing allergies. So that is pretty well known, surprisingly, to so many people. And they were there specifically asking questions about how filtered was the honey, where was it sourced, was it local sourced, and so on. So people seem pretty attuned to that. All in all, a fair is an interesting experience. You get to really test your mettle as to how much you know about beekeeping because people ask you such a wide gamut of questions. But in general, a very positive experience to get out amongst the public and promote beekeeping. So please be encouraged that if your club, as I said last year when we got to this time, if your club is promoting beekeeping or whatever, sign up, go participate. You will enjoy the experience. The last topic for this episode I wanted to bring you was a source to the Bee Files. It came from the Master Beekeeper Program from Cornell University. They have a page that indicates 9 of the more common types of insects that you're going to encounter. Bald-faced hornets, aerial nesting yellow jackets, bumblebees, carpenter bees, cicada killer wasps. These are very cool-looking critters. Giant hornets, ground nesting and twig nesting solitary bees, obviously honeybees is in this classification, paper wasps, and the last one, number 9, is ground nesting yellow jackets. If you look at the bald-faced hornets and the aerial nesting, they come in a big basketball-sized nest that's paper-based. These are black and yellow insects, very distinct, mostly hairless. They are through North America, and they do have a stinger. They are protective and will sting repeatedly if their nests are disturbed, and they give sources about how to take care of these. It's a painful sting from that one, so I think you want to go there and read about that. Bumblebees are another part of that. They're throughout North America also. Large, robust, hairy, generally black and yellow, but sometimes they have white and orange bands. They're often mistaken for carpenter bees. They generally don't do any damage, and they are a pollinator, so pretty welcome to it. The bumblebees are normally docile and only sting if they're provoked. And unlike honeybees, they have a smooth stinger, so they can sting repeatedly. Generally, you shouldn't have a problem with them. Carpenter bees, also known as wood bees, they're about 3/4 to 1 inch long. They are also throughout North America. They resemble bumblebees, but their hairless abdomen appears metallic black and blue. So if you see that black and blue bee, you're looking at a carpenter bee. Also, the males have a yellow on their face, and that's really important because when you look at it, female carpenter bees are only the ones that will sting when disturbed. The males, identified by the yellow face, are aggressive and will dart towards people near a nest, but the males do not have a stinger. So if you see a yellow face on a carpenter bee, no need to worry there. Cicada killer wasps, and I'm not going to read through all of these, but this one was really fascinating. It's 1 1/8 to 1 5/8 inches long. I found one of these on our driveway last year, and I took a picture of it, and I had it, but I had no idea what it was. It's like a huge queen bee type thing, and what it is a cicada killer. Right now in New Jersey, we're finding cicadas all over the place, and if you go outside on a hot August night, they are so loud that you almost have to talk in an elevated voice just to get up and over them. These type of bees can sting you, very mild to extremely painful. It just depends, but These are really interesting critters because of their size. They're absolutely huge. Next up is the giant hornet, 3/4 to 1 1/8 inches long. These things are pretty big. They're southern Massachusetts, south to Georgia, west to Indiana. You'll find them in forest barns, other buildings like that. They're typically not a problem for you. They are predators of other insects and may help control population of insect pests, so they're not necessarily bad from that standpoint. They don't cause a problem to humans. They mostly avoid confrontation and will only sting if they're threatened. Always get questions about something that we typically refer to around here as a sweat bee. They're really small, 1/4 inch to 1/2 inch in length. They're very fast and very quick. You typically see them buzzing around. They do pollinate crops and native plants. Sometimes they're referred to as solitary bees, and they do a tremendous amount of pollination in the United States. You really don't have to worry about these. They will not usually sting unless threatened, and they can be observed at a close range on a flower or building a nest. They receive their name from licking sweat from people and animals. A sweat bee. Next up, and the last two are probably ones that you should pay the most attention to. Paper wasps are 1/2 to 1 inch long. They live in these little tiny bundles that are attached by a small thread or filament that goes up, and they hang in a small clasp. Typically the nest is about 2 to 3 inches, and you find them underneath an overhang. Personal experience with one of these hanging underneath where we turn the switch on to turn the pool on and off, the pool filter. Always reach in there and they get me. They're really very difficult to face. If a paper wasp approaches you, raise your hands to your face and walk away. Be calm with them. Avoid swatting or running. As soon as you do something quick, it could elicit attack. You don't want to use soaps, perfumes, or whatever when you're around them. And really, these have a smooth stinger. They could keep stinging you. And you're going to want to spray them with something that you could be far away from them. These are very aggressive around their nest and will protect their nest. They are reddish brown on the body with black to yellowish rings around the abdomen. And it should be noted that they can be found throughout North America. Last but not least, let's talk about the yellow jacket. Eastern yellow jacket is in the ground. German yellow jacket is another version of this, 1/2 inch to 5/8 inch long. These are stout, mostly hairless body, black with bright yellow markings on the head, thorax, and abdomen. They also have yellow legs, and they fly with their legs close to their body. These are all over North America. Typically, you'll find them at meadows and edge of large forests. They build their nests underground and underneath fallen logs or tree stumps. A lot of people complain about yellow jackets, but the truth of the matter is they are social insects and they do take care of eating many harmful insects. So they are beneficial. You can usually leave them if they don't pose a risk, and they will die out or go away in the fall. I believe if I read correctly, they do not use the same nest over and over again. Now, a yellow jacket nest can cause structural damage if it's built in a wall or attic. So if you have them in there, you want to make sure you get rid of them. And they are also scavengers for food, so they may show up as unwelcome guests at picnics. In the end, a lot of people complain about honeybees and they talk about being stung, but what they're getting stung by is, in my estimation, yellow jackets that are really aggressive. So that's a rundown of a bunch of different insects as they've been identified by the Master Beekeepers Program. We'll provide a link to this stinging insect index. It's at masterbeekeeping.org, but you can check out our show notes. Once again, www.bkcorner.org. Well, that's going to wrap it up for this episode of the Beekeeper's Corner podcast. We appreciate you stopping by. And if you have any comments or thoughts, suggestions for topics of the show, we'd love to hear from you. Please give us a call at 609-460-4037 U.S. You can leave a message. Please let us know how to pronounce your name and what type of topic or question you have for the podcast. As always, you can send a note if you are the writing type. Emails can reach us at kevin@bkcorner.org. Show notes, past episodes, and videos are available at www.bkcorner.org. Going to give a plug to our Northwest New Jersey Beekeepers Association page. That website address, nwba.njbeekeepers.org. We've been posting a bunch of videos over there along with information about beekeeping. It's kind of an adjunct site to this one. As I've said before, most of the video audio stuff that we run across from other club members and myself posted over there, and we don't duplicate the effort here on the Beekeeper's Corner podcast. We just keep it all in the family here with the podcast proper. So if you're interested, nwba.njbeekeepers.com. That's going to wrap it up for this episode. Thanks to everybody for listening. We'll catch you next time on the Beekeeper's Corner.